Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Narayanam Namaskritya. Naram Chaiva Narottamam. Devim Saraswatim Vyasam. Tato Jayam Udirayet. Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 5, Chapter 14, Text 41, Translation. When the conditioned soul accepts the shelter of the creeper of fruit of activity, he may be elevated by his pious activities to higher planetary systems and thus gain liberation from hellish conditions, but unfortunately, he cannot remain there. After reaping the results of his pious activities, he has to return to the lower planetary systems. In this way, he perpetually goes up and comes down. Purport. In this regard, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu says, Brahmande Brahmite Kona Bhagyavan Ji Guru Krishna Prasade Pai Bhakti Lata Bij. Even if one wanders for many millions of years, from the time of creation until the time of annihilation, one cannot get free from the path of material existence unless one receives the shelter at the lotus feet of a pure devotee. As a monkey takes shelter of the branch of a banyan tree and thinks he is enjoying, the conditioned soul, not knowing the real interest of his life, takes shelter of the path of karmakanda, fruit of activities. Sometimes he is elevated to the heavenly planets by such activities, and sometimes he again descends to earth. This is described by Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu as Brahmande Brahmite. However, if by Krishna's grace one is fortunate enough to come under the shelter of the Guru, by the mercy of Krishna, he receives lessons on how to execute devotional service to the Supreme Lord. In this way, he receives a clue of how to get out of his continuous struggle up and down within the material world. Therefore, the Vedic injunction is that one should approach a spiritual master. The Vedas declare, Tad vijnanartham sagurum eva bhigachet. Similarly, in Bhagavad Gita 4.34, the Supreme Personality of Godhead advises, Tad viddi pranipatena pariprashnena sevaya upadekshanti te jnanam jnaninas tattvadarshanaha. Just try to learn the truth by approaching a spiritual master. Inquire from him submissively and render service unto him. The self-realized soul can impart knowledge unto you because he has seen the truth. Srimad Bhagavatam 11.3.21 gives similar advice. Tasmad gurum prapadyeta jigasu shreya uttamam shabde pare nishnatam brahmani upasamashrayam. Any person who seriously desires to achieve real happiness must seek out a bona fide spiritual master and take shelter of him by initiation. The qualification of his spiritual master is that he must have realized the conclusion of the scriptures by deliberation and be able to convince others of these conclusions. Such great personalities who have taken shelter of the Supreme Godhead, leaving aside all material considerations, are to be understood as bona fide spiritual masters. Similarly, Vishwanath Chakravarti, a great Vaishnav, also advises, Yasya prasadad bhagavat prasada. By the mercy of the spiritual master, one receives the mercy of Krishna. This is the same advice given by Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, Guru Krishna prasade pai bhakti lata bij. This is essential. One must come to Krishna consciousness, and therefore one must take shelter of a pure devotee, Thus, one can become free from the clutches of matter. People in the material world sometimes have a problem with the idea of surrendering to another person, just like we've surrendered to a spiritual master. It takes humility, takes giving up your false pride and being respectful to someone else because of their knowledge. And they think, well, I don't want to surrender to another person. Why should I accept somebody else as superior to me in a spiritual sense? But actually, they do it anyway. In the material world, if you want to learn something, you have to go to a teacher. If you want to become a doctor, you have to go to the school and study under so many teachers, which are same as a guru. In India, when you study music, you go to a guru. And you don't just pay him money and then he teaches you. You have to ask him, will you please accept me? And he may not accept you or she may not accept you. So you have to act in a way that causes the spiritual master to feel that you're a worthy recipient of the knowledge that he or she has. Even in the material world, people who have knowledge and are teachers, they're called gurus. For a living, I program computers. But I do custom business applications for companies, very complex programs that they use to run their businesses. And without even saying anything, people started calling me the Mac Guru. You're the Mac Guru, automatically. So the idea is already there, that somebody who has knowledge is a guru. Other people with knowledge are called pundits, people who have are political experts or economic experts or something like that. They're called pundits. So the Vedas have snuck in a little bit, but they don't really understand the full meaning of these words. But it's nice that they're using them because it makes it easier to cross over. But to learn material knowledge, you don't necessarily have to be humble. You just have to pay a fee and show up in the class, take the test, get a good score, and you get your degree, and you become qualified. But it's not that easy. You can't pay a spiritual master. A spiritual master doesn't want money. He wants to see, because the spiritual master is really a friend of Krishna, a lover of Krishna. And if you want to get to know somebody very powerful, even in the material world, if you want to know a movie star or a famous sports person or a famous musician or politician, you can't just walk up to them and immediately get an audience with them and find out everything about them on an intimate level. You have to first approach someone, an intermediary, somebody who's their secretary, or better still, a friend who knows them. And if you get on the good side of their friend, they'll say, you know what, I think my famous friend, my powerful friend would like to meet you. You're a nice person. I think you would get along and I'll introduce you. And then when you meet the famous person, it's still up to that famous person or that powerful person to decide how much they want to let you know about them. They're not immediately going to tell you everything about their intimate affairs with their family members or their husband or wife or whatever, or how they think. But they'll be very nice to you and very friendly in a formal sort of way, or maybe even informal, until you develop a relationship with them. And if they're attracted to you on the basis of a friendship, and all friendships, even in the beginning, they're based on liking someone. Not necessarily love in the beginning, but you like somebody, you appreciate them, and as you grow to appreciate them and like them more, maybe even moving towards the stage of feeling some sort of love for them, then you reveal more to them, or they reveal more to you. So it's the same exact thing with Krishna. You know, Krishna is the personality of Godhead. He's not God. Yes, he's God, but really the form of Krishna with Radharani, is God when he doesn't want to be God, the supreme almighty being. Krishna's been the almighty being forever and ever and ever and ever. So it's not like it's so exciting for him. What's exciting for Krishna is to have a relationship And because a relationship is the way that you exchange love. And love is the most powerful feeling, the most powerful experience that is available. That's what we're after. Krishna prema, love of God. And not only do we want to feel our original love for Krishna, but we want to feel Krishna loving us. You imagine seeing Krishna for the first time? That moment, whenever it comes, when we finally transcend material conditioning, takes a long time, step by step, inch by inch, round by round, obeisance by obeisance, chapati by chapati, you know. But someday, one day, there'll be that day when we look at Krishna, when Krishna says, all right, I'm going to let you see what I look like. We've read so many descriptions. His eyes are like lotus petals. His lips are like this. His hair is like this. So we have an idea, and we see so many pictures of artists' representation and the deities and the carving and everything. But that day when we actually see Krishna for the first time, and that day will also be marked by the greatest feeling of love up to that point in our existence that we have ever experienced. Certainly before that, we'll be experiencing bhava and all the preliminary stages of prema. But when we finally get to see Krishna, when he finally says, okay, you love me so much, I'm convinced I'm going to let you see what I look like and who I am, and you're going to meet me. What a wonderful thing. I think Prabhupada said once, Krishna will shake your hand. You know, I remember seeing once in a Christian booklet, and they said, nobody knows what God looks like. In fact, if you saw God, you would dissolve. Because God is so powerful that you would just shatter and dissolve into nothingness. And they had a picture of God, and it was this big giant man on a big throne. Wasn't very fancy, because even though they think God is all powerful, but somehow or another he can't have fancy things. And even though God is powerful, he still hasn't figured out how not to get old or shave. He's an old man. But we know that God is Nava Yovanam. And I remember Prabhupada, when he wanted to see this church in Toronto that I told him about, that we wanted to get for a temple. So when he came to Toronto, he said, can we go see the church? And I said, yes, let's go. So we went to the church, and the people had moved out, so it was empty. But they still had some things left, and there was still a minister there. And he let us in, and we were walking around, and Prabhupada noticed some books on a table. And it said, what does God look like? And Prabhupada said to me, ask him if we can buy this. I said, can we buy this book? He said, oh, you can have it. So I took the book and we went in the car, and Prabhupada said, read it to me. I want to see what they say. So I started reading in a few pages, and Prabhupada said, they're just bluffing. They don't know what God looks like. But we know, but the only way to get to see Krishna is by the mercy of a spiritual master. And really, mercy is a form of love. The spiritual master wants to see how much love do you have for Krishna. Show me how much love you have for Krishna by showing me how much love you have for me. Not me, the spiritual master. And so the process of devotional service, it seems like it's mechanical. So many rounds, so many chanting, prayers, this, that. It's vaidhi bhakti, regulated, just like health has to be regulated. You have to sleep so many hours, eat a certain amount of food, certain variety of food, so many herbs. And if you have a systematic approach to your health, then you can maintain steady health. If you have a systematic approach to spiritual life, then you can grow. But really what happens is the process of bhakti yoga is a cleansing process. For millions and millions and millions, we can't even count how many bodies we've had. And in every body, we've been under the influence of the modes of nature. And it's sort of cumulative. We're so covered over. We know intellectually, I'm not this body. But we don't get it. We don't feel it. It doesn't feel like I'm not this body. It feels like I'm sweating and I'm hot. I'm inside this robot. Really, that's what the body is. It's an organic robot, controlled like a puppet. And we're just riding in it like a car, but we're experiencing it. It's an interactive experience, 3D video kind of thing. But we're trapped. You just can't get out. You can't say, I'm finished the game, shut down the computer and walk away. You can't do it. You're stuck. You have to stay there. And you can't. There's no process to get out mechanically. The process of devotional service in the beginning is to make a shift from chaotic material life, and it's chaotic because we're following the senses. Our senses are like wild animals, going smelling, seeing, touching, tasting. We're out of control. You know, chasing after everything. The mind's, go, get it, go, oh, over there, no, over there, over here, over there. You know? And the intelligence becomes the servant instead of the master. The mind says, come on, tell me how to figure out how to get this, figure out how to get that. And it's chaos, it's insanity. Because no sooner do you get whatever the object of your desire is, and you experience that happiness. And it's great, it's wonderful for a little while. And then it's gone, and then it's a memory. Oh, remember that? That was such a good meal. That was such a good this, that, the other thing. But it's never satisfying. No matter how much pleasure you get, the satisfaction is just temporary. And you have to go after it again. So this is kind of a madness, kind of an insanity. And you can see it to all extremes in the material world. You can see it in your own life, for sure. Up to the point where we all became Vaishnavas, we had a crazy life in one way or another, chasing after things like madmen, madwomen. It's normal. Now, to shift away from that, first you need knowledge, jnana. And then with knowledge, you need to withdraw a little bit, but you can't do it artificially. You can't just give up the material world. Oh, now I know. It's nonsense. It's maya. I give it up. Can't do it. It's not possible. That's artificial. So many of my God brothers tried to do that, and they didn't have success. They had fell down, because it's not possible to do it artificially. Arjuna wanted to give it up. I'm not going to fight. That's my teacher, my grandfather, my friends. How can I shoot and kill them? I can't do it. I know it's a just cause. I know it's the right thing to do. You're here. You're telling me. But in my mind, I can't see. I'm going to go away and live in the forest. I think that would be better. Krishna said, no, you won't. Every man, every woman has to act because we're compelled according to our nature. Your material body has a certain nature. You know, Brahman, Kshatriya, Vaishya, Shudra, whatever. And we're stuck with it. In fact, in the Bhagavad Gita, 700 verses, there's only two verses that Krishna repeats. So you know, it's the song of God. When you repeat something in a song, it's like a chorus. Krishna repeats two verses. The one verse is, just perform your prescribed duty. Don't do somebody else's duty. Don't try to be a Brahmin if you're a Vaishya, just because you think a Brahmin is more pure. That's not the idea. The Varnas are not spiritual. They're material. So whatever you are, Shudra, Vaishya, Kshatriya, Brahmin, doesn't matter, really. Don't change that. Change your consciousness. Change your mindset. That we can change. You can't change your material nature. But we can revive our spiritual consciousness while engaging in the activities and the duties of our material nature. This is the key. The other verse that Krishna repeats is, Manmana Bhava Madbhakto. While you're doing all this, just think of me. Meditate on me. Instead of meditating on the objects of desire, wealth, fame, this, that, try to shift. Not easy. You can't do it all of a sudden. It's gradual. So you slowly, just like when you're six, you just can't take a pill and immediately you're cured. You have to slowly give up whatever it was that was making you sick and take on things that will bring back the balance and take on things that will increase health and strength. And then over a course of time, your body gets stabilized, comes into balance, and then you keep taking things that give you strength so you can maintain your health and do battle against disease and unwanted things. So the spiritual life is the same thing. You have to have a program. Whatever it is, it has to be a program that you can follow. Not everybody lives in the temple and has the luxury of getting up early in the morning. But you make a temple in your home. This is the most important thing for people who don't live in the temple. Make your home, have a temple in your home, make a program. The most important thing about the program is that you can do it every day. If you can't do 16 rounds, do 8 rounds, do 4, do even just do 1. Krishna says that in the Gita. If you can't do this, do that. If you can't do that, do this. If you can't do that, do this, do this, do this. All the way down. He's not trying to keep us away. He's trying to get us in. And he's not saying, boy, if you can't do this, go away. In the Christian world and other religions, they say, you got one chance, otherwise you're going to hell forever, burn, because God is mean and nasty, and he doesn't like you if you missed your one chance. Well, we know that's nuts. That's crazy. It doesn't work like that. Krishna's so kind. Just to get to this point where we're chanting in front of deities, going to Vrindavan, we have to understand that we've been doing this for many lifetimes. This isn't the first time. We're picking up where we left off. Because each one of us probably has the same feeling that when we, however old we were, whether we were a child or a teenager or 20s or 30s or 50s, when we came to Krishna consciousness in this lifetime, it was a feeling of something familiar. Something like, yes, this is what I've been looking for my whole life. This feels like what I was supposed to be doing. It's very familiar, very comfortable. It doesn't feel artificial, it doesn't feel forced. Yeah, we have to force ourselves to get up, but the process doesn't feel forced. It feels natural. And you feel inclined to do it. Because we've been doing it for many lifetimes. Because it takes that long. Who knows how long? It's up to every individual. You could do it fast or not. Most of us are going to do it slowly but surely, step by step. Why? Because the material world is so strong. It pulls you. It's like chains. And no sooner do you think, and the false ego makes you think, oh boy, you're getting pretty advanced. Look at how much you're chanting so many years. And then as soon as you feel good about it, Maya comes in and goes, and then down. Just to make you humble. And you go, man, I guess I wasn't advanced as I thought I was. So all these things have to be learned from somebody who's done it already. Who's that? The spiritual master. He's done it. He's doing it. Most importantly, Acharya. He's doing it. Then you can see. I see him doing it. I get it. You know, you can read about something, but when you actually live with somebody and you watch them do it, and you're in their presence and you feel their energy, it inspires you. It gives you hope. It gives you hope. And when you have hope, you can be enthusiastic. Krishna makes you enthusiastic because when you engage in the process, again, don't do it mechanically. You have to do it from the heart. We're not chanting 16 rounds. We're associating with Krishna through his holy name. That's what japa is. It's not, 16 and 108 names. And it's associating with Krishna through his name. We take prasadam. We're gratifying our tongue, but really we're associating with Krishna through transcendental food. We're getting purified. Idang Bhagavatam Nama. The Bhagavatam is the person of God in the form of a book. Krishna came 5,000 years ago. He said, you know what? You can never figure out what I'm like. It's impossible. Do you imagine sitting down before we knew about Krishna and speculating? I wonder what God's like. Is he like this? Is he like that? You never get it. It's impossible. You know, if you speculate, the best you can do is the Brahma Jyoti. You know, and even that, it's best if you study the Vedas to understand the Brahma Jyoti or Brahman. But to understand Krishna, there's no way. It's impossible. You have to find out from one of his friends. And thank Krishna that he has lots of friends, or even one friend. All you need is one friend, the spiritual master. And you approach the spiritual master. Convince him that you're sincere. How? By your service. By austerities and service. Sincerity is the most important thing. Really, that's how you get to Krishna, by sincerity, by being honest with yourself. Don't pretend you're somewhere that you're not. Better to be humble and work up slowly. It's not important to be so advanced and be a big devotee. Back in the 70s, so many people, he's a big devotee, he's a big devotee. Yeah, and they had a big fall, crash, because it was artificial. Artificial doesn't work. Honesty and sincerity work. So you have to look inside your heart and say, where am I at? How strong are my material desires? Don't be false and think you can give them up immediately. The best you can do is regulate them. And Krishna's nice. He's wonderful. He lets us fulfill our desires. Not everything, not all of them, all at once. It's not that you chant Hare Krishna and you can run out and you're all of a sudden you're driving a Mercedes and you have $1 million in the bank. You know? Really, the fulfillment of desires is still somewhat dependent on karma. So we all have our bank account of karma. And if you have enough, you can go up to the heavenly planets. But as soon as you empty your bank account, back down again to work to fill up your bank account again. You have to be careful. In the material world, it's also easy to do bad things. And then instead of going up, you might have to go down for a while and not burn forever, but burn for a while or get smacked around or whatever. And we know what it feels like to get smacked around. We've all had suffering in our life. When I suffer, I say, I don't know what I did to deserve this suffering, but I hope I didn't do it very much. And when something good happens, I say, I don't know what I did to deserve this, but I hope I did it a lot. You know? And we know that Krishna, we're told in the Shastra that for devotees, Krishna, sometimes he'll make an adjustment. We don't know, it's not a guarantee, but we know that he can. And if he feels like it, because he's independent, he may do that. In fact, a devotee thinks, you know, I'm suffering now, but I bet I deserve more, and by Krishna's mercy, he made it just less, like this. So I probably deserve more. He just assumes that Krishna's helping him, because Krishna loves us. How do we know that Krishna loves us? Because since the beginning of our coming to the material world, he expanded one more time just for us inside our heart, just to sit there and go through all of the crazy things that we've done. Could you imagine sitting through all the crazy things that, and he's just sitting there watching. It doesn't affect him. I'm surprised that he's not bored, but thank goodness he's self-satisfied, Atmarama, so he doesn't get bored, because, you know, our lives can be very boring, very pathetic sometimes. But he's there for only one reason. He doesn't have to be there. He's only there because he loves us. Now imagine how many living entities there are, how many mosquitoes, how many bugs, how many birds and trees and plants, and every bit of the material universe is occupied by living entities. And Krishna is in the heart of every single one because he has that much love. He never runs out of love. He never runs out. And he goes in there. He says, I'm going to wait until you come to the point of wanting to know about me, and then I'm going to help you. As soon as somebody says, you know, I really want to know the truth. What's the truth of life? What is it? What could it be? I'm reading, I'm looking, I'm asking. And Krishna's in your heart, and when he sees that you're sincere, he says, here, I want you to meet my friend, the spiritual master, the guru. He knows, he'll tell you everything. Make friends with him, serve him, surrender to him, please him. If he's pleased with you, he'll give you mercy. Mercy is another form of love. This is all about love. You know, everything in this spiritual process is about love. It's Prabhupada's love for us that we have these books. He was in Vrindavan. He didn't have to come. He was an old man. You know, I traveled from Los Angeles to Dublin to Amsterdam to Delhi to Vrindavan to Jaipur here. It kills to travel. It's, you know, he's so tired, just cramped in the plane. Prabhupada went around the world 14 times in 12 years. In his 70s, when your body isn't working so good. Imagine how uncomfortable. 14 times, just to go so people could see him and know, yes, there really is a pure devotee. There really is a pure devotee. I saw him. I met him. I heard him. The first time I saw Prabhupada was when he came off the plane at San Francisco. And as soon as he came around, there was a wall like this and the people were coming. And as soon as he came around, we were chanting. There was a lot of devotees. The chanting went up like this. And everybody went crazy. And tears started pouring from my eyes. I wasn't planning on crying, but I couldn't help it. And I just looked at him, and it was so unbelievable. Then there was Rathiatra, and they said, well, you were a musician, set up the PA system on the cart, so when Prabhupada gives his talk, you know, you set it up. So I was on the cart, I set up the speakers and the mixer and the microphone, and Prabhupada got on the cart and he was underneath. And I went, I came all this way to see Prabhupada. Now I can't see him. He's underneath. And before that, we would always listen to lectures on the tape. So there I was standing, and here's the speaker, and I'm listening, and it sounds just like the tape. Only I know he's down there, sitting underneath. And then I remembered what Bhaktisiddhanta said. One does not go to see the spiritual master. One goes to hear the spiritual master. You know, Vani, not Vapu. Vapu's nice, but Vani's better. Most of us in the 70s didn't see Prabhupada that much. Once in a while, I didn't have so much association, but I had some nice times, about an hour's worth if I tell all the stories. But mostly I heard from Prabhupada's books. That's what I love the most, because in Prabhupada's books, this is his heart. He's pouring out his heart. Imagine he's in Vrindavan before he came, and he's, you know, all his life he's been a devotee, most of his life. Well, all his life, but as far as feeling inclined to spread Krishna consciousness. And I know we all feel that way. You know, you read these books and you feel like you want to. When I first read the Gita, I thought I was going to convert the whole city. All I was going to talk to my friends one by one. Next, next. Just give me 1 hour, you'll be a devotee. 1 hour. After 3 hours, they go, well, that's nice for you, but, you know, bye. I couldn't convert anybody. I thought, why don't you get it? It makes so much sense. It's logical. It's reasonable. It's perfect. And I could tie it together, all the little parts. But if somebody's not ready, you can't make them a devotee. It's not possible. But still, inside our hearts, we're bursting. We want to give it. It's a free gift. It's like we have a handful of diamonds. I'm going to the, would you like a diamond? No, thanks. I have some glass. I don't need a diamond. You know, this knowledge is like diamonds. You can't go up. We'll walk down the street. Everybody's conditioned by the material energy. We want to shake them and go, guess what? We know the truth. The truth has been here all along. I want to give it to you. It's free. It doesn't cost anything. Do you want it? No, thanks. I have to go to work. I have to do this. I have to do that. Entangled, you know. Prabhupada, his whole life, he just wanted to give this knowledge so that people would have a chance. He was in Vrindavan translating the Bhagavatams, thinking, I'll come to America. He came to America. He had a thick accent. People couldn't, it was hard to understand him. But somehow or another, he gave it. If he didn't come, I wouldn't be sitting here. I mean, he poured his heart out in his books. The books are one of the most powerful representations of the Guru. Prabhupada's left, Nitya Lila, now he's gone. But we have his books. He only stayed 10 years. Everybody thought, oh, why couldn't you stay 20 years? I thought about it and I thought, you know what? This is Krishna's way of forcing us to take shelter of Prabhupada's books. The knowledge is there. This is the key. This is our chance for making advancement and becoming purified up to the point of pure love. This is the guidance we get. Now, in the 70s, you know, Prabhupada came to Toronto twice. And when I was in Chicago, he came once. Montreal, he didn't come when I was president, but he stayed for an afternoon. So if we had to depend on the personal presence of the spiritual master, it wouldn't be so easy. So spiritual master gives us teachings, and the teachings are the key. That's what we can take. You can read it over and over again. How many times did you read the Gita? When I was temple president, we used to read the Srimad Bhagavatam, just the first two cantos, and then start again. And then I told the devotees, you can read on your own, third canto, fourth canto. That's your private study. But for discussion in the class, we're going to stick to the first two and drill it into our heads. And to make it easy, we shaved our heads, so it wasn't any thick there, you know. Because this is the key to connecting with the spiritual master, the knowledge, by receiving the knowledge, Krishna said, you worship him with your intelligence. That's how you use your intelligence for God in service. You worship him with your intelligence by studying the books. And Krishna says, if you do that, then through your intelligence, I'll help you. One of the processes of devotional service is sakyam, making a friendship with Krishna. Now, we don't know, am I a gopi, am I a cowherd boy, am I a peacock, am I a cow? Am I a mother, a father? I don't know. We won't know until we get to that stage. At least Brahmabhuta, you need to get there. And then from Brahmabhuta, pure devotional service begins, and from there, all of the details unfold. But in the meantime, we can develop a friendship with Krishna. You talk to Krishna every day. Krishna, please help me. How should I understand this? How should I see this? How should I think? How should I act? What should I do? What should I tell this person? How should I behave? You know, have a conversation. We can do that. That's not being artificial. That's not being false. That's sakyam. And part of the nine processes. It opens up your heart. Because really, devotional service is all about having a relationship with Krishna. And part of it is having a relationship with devotees. And we love being with devotees because they're such nice people. The devotees here are so wonderful. It melted my heart from the moment I walked in. I couldn't believe it. This is a little glimpse of the love. Now we want to go to be with Krishna and Krishna Loka. It doesn't mean that it's just me and Krishna. It means me and lots of other people. Loving Krishna. Everybody loves Krishna. You can't have him all to yourself. You have to share him. But in the spiritual world, it doesn't matter. It feels good. It feels wonderful. Even though you're sharing Krishna, you still feel like you're getting everything you need from Krishna. It's a perfect relationship. But while we're developing that at the stage we're at now, we have to develop relationships with each other. That doesn't mean you have to love every single devotee because we're still materially conditioned. So you have to find people that you feel comfortable with. Some devotees you'll have more intimate friendship than others. Others may be a little bit more formal or just acquaintance. It doesn't matter. It's some kind of relationship. So the most important things that the spiritual master is teaching us, how to have a relationship with Krishna in the right mood, the mood of love. And the beginning of love is service and humility. Because Krishna doesn't want anybody who's puffed up or arrogant or thinks that they're special. Because, you know, you get to Krishna Loka, you're going to realize there's so many special people. Even here, so many devotees, so many special devotees. You can't get puffed up. You get puffed up, you're going to get smacked. For sure. So, this is the most important thing to learn from the spiritual master. How to develop a relationship with Krishna, have a nice relationship with devotees. Because without devotees, you know, you don't make advancement. All we had in the 70s were ourselves. Helping one another, talking to one another, advising one another. You know, that's how we made advancement. Using Prabhupada's books as the guideline. You know, he gave it to us like that. So, we're so fortunate that Prabhupada came and that we have so many nice devotees who are taking on disciples. Radhanath Swami, such a wonderful devotee, my friend, your guru. And he's doing such a wonderful thing. But still, we have to teach each other. We become each other's shiksha gurus. Everybody needs a guru. And you can be a guru to everybody. One diksha guru, many shiksha gurus. I see. Even if you need to learn how to drive, you need a guru. I call it a rickshaw guru. But most important thing is spiritual guru. So, Krishna is so kind that he's sent his friends to us. And everybody here, we wouldn't be here if you weren't taking advantage of it. So we just keep doing that and make progress step by step. Let the love come out. The love is already there. Let it come out. Let it manifest as love for one another. And that pleases Krishna. He sees that we can love one another, not artificially, not phony, but genuine. Appreciate everybody's good qualities, all the nice things that everybody's doing. And then that enhances the loving experience because we're leading up to the most incredible loving experience. An experience that's so powerful that when you feel it inside, your body will start to shake. Your hairs will stand on end. Tears will shoot out of your eyes. These are just symptoms of something going on inside that's really powerful. So overwhelming that your body can't function anymore. It's because it's, you know, overwhelmed. This is the gift of the spiritual master. So, thank you very much. Any questions?
Thank you, Prabhuji, for a very simple but yet profound, heart-churning presentation and revealing your heart's realizations. There's no question, just so that you can continue talking a little more. If you could tell us about how we met Prabhupada. And
I'll tell you one of my favorite stories. A couple of little things. When Prabhupada came to Toronto, he only stayed for one day, and he came just to see this big church that we found. And I told you, we took him to the church, he saw everything. But before he came to Toronto, he was in Chicago. And I happened to be in Chicago because it was a big Rath Yatra, so I went there, and I was helping out. And he stayed there for a week. And one evening, I had darshan with Prabhupada and a few other devotees because I was going to tell him about this building that we found. We were looking for a new temple. And I said, Prabhupada, we found this big church, huge church, 30-foot-high ceiling in the main room, perfect for a big temple room. You can hold 1,000 people. There's a big room for a prasadam room, quarters for living, kitchen, everything. And I was describing it. And he said, oh, he was getting so excited. He thought it was really nice. He said, well, how much do they want? I said, $500,000. Now, this is in 1975. So that's huge. No one had ever bought a temple that expensive. Just before this, they bought the Detroit Temple, which was an old mansion. They bought it for $300,000. It was a $10 million mansion. But the area around the mansion became degraded. And so that no rich person wanted to live there because they had to live in the slums. It was a $10 million mansion. So they bought it for $300,000. It was unbelievable. And Prabhupada gave them $100,000. $100,000. The BBT had never given that much money to help buy a temple. That was never done before. So I told Prabhupada, well, they want $500,000. And he said, well, it sounds nice, but why purchase anxiety? You know, if we spend that much money, then we're going to spend all day collecting money to pay the mortgage, and we'll just be in anxiety over money. We shouldn't purchase anxiety. I said, I understand, Prabhupada. So I thought, all right, we'll look for another one. And he said, so it's on a big street, it's on the main street. I said, yes, Prabhupada, Avenue Road, thousands of cars every day go up and down. Ah, wonderful. But we don't want to purchase anxiety. Yes, Prabhupada. And the temple room, it's big? Oh, yes, 30-foot high, balcony, thousands of devotees, perfect place for an altar. And Prabhupada was like, "This," but we don't want to purchase anxiety, too much money. We don't want to purchase anxiety. He kept saying this over and over. And I thought, okay, I get it. We don't want to purchase anxiety. And so I thought, all right, well, we'll just look for another place. And then a few days later, he said, Prabhupada wants to come to Toronto. Okay, great. And then I got excited. And they said, oh, he can't come. Oh, okay. And then a few hours later, okay, he's coming now. Okay, great. Oh, he can't come. It was like three times, up and down, up and down. Finally, he's coming. So we get him, we go to the church, he looks around, he sees everything, we go back. And then later that night, I get a phone call. Prabhupada wants you to come over to the apartment right away. So I go over to the apartment. And he said, so, you have all the plans for this temple, everything, or is it in your head, or is it on paper? I said, no, Prabhupada, I have all the plans on paper, all the blueprints. I know exactly how to set everything up. He said, okay. He said, let's do this. You go tomorrow with Jagadish, and we're going to offer $300,000 cash. And you tell him, we'll worship Lord Jesus. We'll put a deity of Lord Jesus on the altar next to Krishna. And we'll worship Jesus and Krishna at the same time. So then they'll feel good that it's still a church of Jesus and also Krishna. I said, okay, why not? And then I said, what about the money, Prabhupada? He said, well, Brahmananda, tell the BBT to give them $200,000. Brahmananda went, $200,000? Prabhupada, we've never done that before. That's the entire, all the money in the BBT. I don't care, give it to them. He said, how much money do you have? I said, well, Prabhupada, we've collected $40,000. So you collect another $60,000, that's $300,000. I said, $300,000. I said, okay. I said, Prabhupada, that's a lot of money, Prabhupada. We don't want to purchase anxiety. There must be anxiety. He slammed his fist on the table. There must be anxiety. I fell over, almost, you know. He said, otherwise, we'll sit around eating prasadam, get fat. What kind of devotional service is that? Must go out and work for Krishna. Then you must be in anxiety for Krishna. So, I thought I was being a good disciple. You know, oh, we don't want to purchase anxiety. I remembered. Oh, yeah? There must be anxiety. Big slam on the desk. So we went to the guy the next day, and we sat down and we made him the offer. He said, 300,000. Forget it. I have offers. Look at all these offers for 500,000. Somebody wants to make a shopping mall. Somebody wants to make it into a school. Somebody wants to make it into this. We're choosing who we want to sell it to. We don't want to sell it to anybody. We want to choose. We want it to be somebody special gets this church. 300,000, forget it. So we went back, told Prabhupada. Prabhupada said, that's okay. We'll find something else. So then I left, and that's when I became president of Chicago Temple, and my good friend Vishwakarma Prabhu took over for me in Toronto. So over the course of about a year, he was determined to get this temple. And so in partnership with the Hindu community in Toronto, it's a big community, they came up with a plan that and raised the money, $500,000, unbelievable, and a mortgage, you know, some cash, some mortgage. And they bought the church as a Hindu cultural center, not the Hare Krishna temple, Hindu cultural center. And somehow or another, it worked. So on the day that they went to get the keys, after the transaction was finished, Vishwakarma, before that, he was wearing a wig. Now he just had his shaved head with a hat. He took off his hat, and the minister looked at him, and he said, the Hare Krishnas bought this church, didn't they? And Vishwakarma said, that's right. He said, I would rather burn it down than sell it to the Hare Krishnas. And he gave him a dirty look. Now, fast forward, about a year later, maybe 6 months. Now, across the street was another big church. Now, we're talking church. These are churches with big, big stones, not bricks. Big stone churches, very big. Across the street was another church, still a Christian church. Late one night, about midnight, the devotees are sleeping, and then all of a sudden they hear all this noise. There's all this noise outside, cars, sirens going. They get up. Vishwakarma wakes up, they get dressed, they run outside, and the church across the street is burning, and it burns to the ground. And they determine the cause was arson. Somebody set fire to the church to burn it to the ground. Now, in North America and Canada, nobody burns down a church. Nobody is against the Christian religion. Most of the people are Christians. It was arson. Somebody burned down a church on purpose right across the road from the Hare Krishna temple. I would rather burn it down than sell it to the Hare Krishnas. So who knows, but we speculated that Krishna bewildered the arsonist and made them burn down the church. Can't say for sure, but... Now, when I was in Toronto at that time, we had a program at a gentleman's house. And we drove there, and we came in, and the devotees were packed in the living room. Just a little, and it was chanting, kirtan going on. Prabhupada sat down. It was very exciting. And we were all chanting. And then we finished chanting, and everybody sat there waiting for Prabhupada to speak. And Prabhupada looked around, and he looked over at Brahmananda Swami. He said, you speak. And Brahmananda went, nobody wants to speak in front of Prabhupada. No matter how many classes you might have given in the temple, to speak in front of Prabhupada, it's terrifying. It's terrifying. In fact, inside my mind, I was thinking, ha, 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 ha. he's a sannyasi, you know, Prabhupada's going to make the sannyasi speak because they're big shots, right? And Brahmananda stood up. He was very nervous. He was speaking. And I'm thinking, you know, it's a good thing. And so he finished speaking. I look at Prabhupada, and Prabhupada looks at me. He goes, "Now you speak." And I melted. Om Agnana, stand up. So I stood up, and I felt like I was in outer space. I'm not even sure I was speaking English. But nobody, you know, everybody, I think I said something okay. So that taught me a big lesson. And I was only thinking this. I wasn't making any faces. See? So then we sat down and we had prasadam. And I said, "Prabhupada, do you mind if we chant very softly while everybody has prasadam?" He said, no, that's fine. I said, "Prabhupada, do you have any favorite melodies for Hare Krishna?" He said, "Oh, yes." I said, "Which one?" He said, "All of them." So then we're driving home in the car, and another car pulls up beside us, and it's Ayodhyapati, who's now Bhakti Bringal Govinda Swami. And he was the cook in Toronto, first-class cook. We had such good prasadam. And I said, "Prabhupada," and I said, "this devotee in the other car, this is Ayodhyapati, he's our cook, and we follow your recommendation. We have one main meal a day in the morning, dal, rice, you know, basmati rice, dal, chapatis, good sabji, you know, first class, everything, just right." Prabhupada said, "Oh, thank you very much." And, before that, I forgot. Before that, after we came back from the church, Prabhupada said to me, "So, you're distributing books? The book distribution is going nicely?" I said, "Oh, yes, Prabhupada." And I gave him some scores. Every month, so many big books, so many small books, so many magazines. He said, "Oh, wonderful, excellent." And he said, "Now, at the time, the way I had organized the temple, we'd have Bhagavatam class in the morning, but before Bhagavatam, we would read half an hour of Nectar of Devotion. And then the next day, we would read Nectar of Instruction. Then back to Nectar of Devotion, then Nectar of Instruction, back and forth, and then Bhagavatam. And then at night, before the Gita class, Krishna book one night, Chaitanya Charitamrita the next night, back and forth, and then the Gita." So Prabhupada said, "Now, you're distributing the books, but are you reading them too?" I said, "Yes, Prabhupada. Every day we have five classes." And his eyes went really big. He was shocked. He smiled. "Thank you very much." Oh, I felt so good. I felt so good that I pleased him by doing that. It was just my idea. Nobody else was doing this. But I thought, you know, how are we going to read all these books? Devotees don't have time to sit down and read because there's so many things to do. So we'll make the schedule like that. And he said, "No, so a lot of devotees are coming?" I said, "Not really, Prabhupada. Every 6 months, maybe three or four." He said, "That's okay. Manushanam sahasreshu kaschid yatati siddhaye. You know, don't worry about it. Whatever." So then we flew up to Montreal because he wanted to see the new temple there. And I was president there before, and they just got a new church. So he wanted to see it, and he wanted to give some mercy to the devotees there. But he could only stay for a few hours, and then he had to catch a flight back to Europe. So he took a tour of the temple, and then we had some time before going to the airport we wanted to spend with the devotees. So we went in this little garden at the side of the temple, and Prabhupada was sitting there, and everybody was sitting waiting for him to say something. And he said, "Jagadish," he goes, "read from the Gita." So he took the eighth chapter, you know, the chapter on how yogis leave their body. And he said, "Read something." So Jagadish started reading, and he read the purport. And he said, "Now speak, speak." So Jagadish had to speak, and I thought, uh-oh, here we go again. And after he finished speaking, I looked at Prabhupada, very shy, and he said, "Now you read and you speak." So he made me do it again. So I read whatever consciousness one quits his body, at that consciousness he will attain in his next life. That was the verse that I read. I read the purport, and then I spoke something. Then we went to the airport, and we're sitting in the airport waiting for the flight. And now, do you know Shivaram Swami? Now, Shivaram became a devotee in Montreal when I was president there. And I shaved him up, and I trained him up. And we had big kirtans together. He loved the kirtan. And when I was president of Chicago, and I asked, after Prabhupada left the planet, I asked Krishna, "What should I do?" And he said, you know, "Better to go out in the world and integrate into society and teach people how to live a balanced spiritual life and set an example. And Shivaram took over for me in Chicago. You know, luckily there was somebody qualified, because Chicago Temple was a wonderful temple. Fabulous prasadam, big-time kirtans, big book distribution. The devotees, everybody was happy. Everybody was treated nicely. The women were treated nicely. Even those who didn't distribute books, nobody felt bad. I mean, everybody felt good that they were doing whatever they could to help. So Shivaram Swami was in charge of book distribution in Montreal, and he said, "Prabhupada, the Sankirtan devotees go out to distribute books very early in the morning, and they don't get to take the regular... Is there some special prasadam for them that would be ideal?" Prabhupada said, "Oh, yes." He said, "What is it?" And he looked at me and he said, "Tell him." And I just told, you know, chapatis, rice, dal, sabji. Prabhupada said, "This is ideal." Okay. You want me to keep going? You're going to miss prasadam. I'll tell one more. In the United States, the Thanksgiving Day is a Thursday, the last Thursday in November. It's the big holiday before the Christmas time. And the day before Thanksgiving, Wednesday, is more people travel on that day than any other day of the year. Now, Chicago has a unique airport, because the way it's designed, all the people come through three terminals. So in one day, it's something like 200,000, 300,000 people within 18 to 20 hours. So this is the biggest day for book distribution. And, you know, we were prepared to do this. So I got a phone call from Rameshwar, who is the head of the BBT in Los Angeles. Now, in Chicago, we had about maybe 40 or 50 devotees. And then we had Tripurari Swami with the BBT book distributing party. Like six brahmacharis, six of the best book distributors in the world. You know, brahmacharis. And so that was the collection, the Chicago book distributors and the BBT book party with Tripurari. Very powerful, but only about 50 or 60 people. In LA, they had 300 people. 300 people, big community. So Rameshwar calls me up. He said, "Hey, Uttama. So, day before Thanksgiving's coming, and you think you're going to do a lot of books?" I said, "Well, yeah." He said, "You know, last year, Chicago had the record, the world record for books in one day, 400 big books in one day. Unbelievable. It could only be done on that day because of all the people traveling. Otherwise, you do 40, 50, 60, 100, but 400. He said, "Well, how many do you think you'll do this time?" I said, "I don't know. 800? He said, "800, that's a lot." I said, "Yeah, we'll try. We have lots of nice devotees. We'll organize it." He said, "You know, we think we can do more than you. We can do better." I said, "Oh, yeah? You think so, eh?" He said, "Yeah, not only do we think we can do better than you, we challenge you. We challenge you to a book distribution contest. And the winner gets a picture, an original BBT painting." It was actually Lord Chaitanya and Chota Haridas in his ghost form up above, that one. "We challenge you that we'll distribute more books than you on that day and defeat you." I said, "We accept the challenge. Let the games begin." So I found out afterwards, they had a big meeting in the temple. "We have to defeat Chicago. We have to defeat them. Everybody call up your mother, your father, your cousins, your brothers, and get them to take a book." Everybody, so they had 300 people times 10 books. They think they're going to do a lot of books, you know, running all over Los Angeles. We only had the airport. Now, I told the devotees at the class, I said, "Well, Rameshwar Swami has challenged us. They think, LA thinks they can defeat us." I told him they can't do it. But we didn't do anything really special to try to get the devotees excited. I didn't know rah, 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 rah. We just had the normal kirtan, which was fantastic. It was always wonderful kirtans. We just had a big one. And after kirtan, after Mangal Artik, the devotees went out. And then I had it organized so they could only carry so many books. So somebody was supplying them with books so that they could keep their bag full, that they didn't have to walk over to the locker and get them. And we brought them prasadam like that to keep them well fueled. And I was at the airport. I'm not a very good book distributor, so I was just helping with the organization. And it was a very intense day. So many things happened. I don't even remember all of them. But at one point, we were taking prasadam downstairs in the airport. And some demons, they had got the books, and they ripped them up, and they threw them at us. And we were eating, and these pieces of bhagavatams came at us, you know, like that. And so we just picked them up, you know, put them aside, finished eating, go upstairs, keep distributing. And, you know, you have to imagine 300,000 people in an airport, not all at once, but coming through. It was a huge, it's like downtown Calcutta, sort of, but without the rickshaws and without all the garbage, you know. So at one point, Triparari Swami was talking to somebody, and some demon comes up to him and goes, bam, and smashes him in the face, and he falls over. So Pragosh goes over to the demon, jumps on him, lands on him on the ground and starts pounding the stool out of him. Bam, bam, bam. And then the police come. There's a big commotion. And the guy gets taken away in handcuffs. And we go back to distributing books. You know? So like this. And other little things I can't remember. But those are the big things. On until late at night. Until everybody was completely exhausted. Even till 2 in the morning. Till there was no more people in the airport. And so I got up early, and I'm figuring out the totals, and I do add everything up, and I have the number, and then I call Rameshwar. Hey, Rameshwar. Oh, Uttama. So how did it go? I go, pretty good. It was very, very heavy. So many things. I'll tell you about it later, but it was very heavy. I said, how about you? He said, oh, unbelievable. Just fantastic. I said, really? Well, how many books did you do? Did you do more than 800? He said, oh, yes. Well, how many? More than 1,400? Oh, yes. How many? He said, we did 1,800 books. And I said, 1,800? You did 1,800 books? He goes, oh, yeah. I said, oh, my God. That's unbelievable. He goes, we had everybody out there doing books. 1,800. He said, how many did you do? I said, 2,150. And on the other side, no! Oh! He was devastated. I said, oh yeah, we won, big time. And the devotees, we were ecstatic. Everybody was ecstatic. It was incredible. So then I typed up a letter. It was like 3 pages. And I described the day. I described the whole thing from the beginning of when he called me, just like I told you. But I did it like a story, like a very, you know, embellished narrative story. And I described all of the details of the day, step by step. And then this happened, and that happened, and this happened, and that, all the way up until the end, to when we defeated him. And I sent him the letter as a record, you know, just for him personally, just to rub it in, you know. It was sort of devotional rubbing in, you know. It was bhakti, but it was bhakti rub. And about 2 weeks later, now every week there was a BBT newsletter and all the totals, so many books, every, you know, like that. And in the BBT newsletter, he has the greatest Sankirtan story of all time. And then he had my letter, word for word. He sent it all over the world. And this was the beginning of all the devotees sending in their stories every week. And the BBT newsletter became like Leela, book distribution Leela, every week. And, you know, that started it. Now, 2 weeks later, it was Christmas time, and I came home late from distributing books. And I went up to my office, and on my desk was a little blue aerogram. And back then, when you wanted to send an airmail from overseas, you use this very thin paper, and you just fold it over, and it's blue. And anytime you got one of these, Jai, Radha Gopinath. And the letter said, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami to Uttama Sloka Prabhu. And I thought, I didn't write Prabhupada a letter. Why is he sending me a letter? I didn't. I never wrote him a letter. So I opened it up. My dear Uttama Sloka Prabhu, please accept my blessings. I have read your Sankirtan newsletter with great relish. All glories to the American devotees. They are the real heroes, the real Dhiravrata. They'll do anything for Krishna's service. You are the greatest devotees. And as I was reading it, tears. And then after Mangalartik, I read it to the devotees and everybody was crying. And then I called up Rameshwar and I read it to him on the phone 2 times. And then I sent him a copy and he sent it to everybody all over the world. Hare Krishna. That's enough. Let's take prasadam. Thank you so much.